She has had pets before. He did do the chores. A remarkably complicated thing happens in English when we start to combine auxiliary verbs together. We talked about this briefly in the previous lecture, without the modals, and it's worth reviewing again, both because of the intricacy of the grammar and because of the impressive fact that if you learned English as your native language, you learned to do this with no explicit instruction. Each auxiliary verb specifies the form of the verb that comes after it, and it turns out that whether that's the main verb or another auxiliary verb. A modal is combined with an infinitive. Be, as an auxiliary, is combined with the present participle in ing form. Have is combined with a past participle in en or ed form. Do is combined with an infinitive form. When we start to put multiple auxiliaries together, each one will specify the form of the next one in the string, be that an auxiliary that comes next or the main verb. An example will help here. Let's start with, our dear friend might date a celebrity. Our dear friend might date a celebrity. Might requires an infinitive, so we get might date, date in its infinitive form. Now we add another auxiliary. Our dear friend might be dating a celebrity. Might be dating. So might, as we talked about, requires an infinitive. So we get might and then be in the infinitive form. Be requires an ing form. So date now becomes dating. Might be dating. Let's keep going. Our dear friend might have been dating a celebrity. Might, again, requires the infinitive, so we get have. Have needs a past participle form, so we get been. Be wants that ing, so we get dating. Might have been dating. I mentioned already a couple of changes that have happened in auxiliary verbs in the history of English. We have, for example, that could and should used to be past tenses of can and shall. Periphrastic do emerged in the history of English. Then there are some changes happening around us right now with auxiliary verbs declining and getting added. There are two modals that are in serious decline. The first, which probably won't surprise you, is shall. If you search Google Books using the Ngram viewer, it shows about an 80% drop in the use of shall over the past 200 years. The corpus of historical American English, which allows you to search written material over the last 200 years, shows an even more dramatic decline in shall. Shall is preserved in phrases like, shall we? But I think that for many of us, if you answer that with, we shall, it sounds a little bit like a joke, and you can hear what I did with my voice right there, we shall, because it isn't very colloquial for me to say, we shall. While we're talking about shall, let's address a usage issue that maybe you've heard of, but I would guess that at least most of you probably don't follow. There is a rule out there about shall versus will. For those of you who know it, the idea is that one expresses future and one expresses obligation, and it varies by person. In the first person, I or we, shall expresses future and will expresses obligation. In second and third person, will expresses future and shall expresses obligation. Has this ever been true? Well, as far as we can tell, it's never been that neat. It seems to be more true in British English than in American English, but there's some chance that for the prescriptivists who are now trying to enforce this rule, they're trying to create a logical system where there may never have been a system that was quite this logical. You can, however, still find this rule in a usage guide like Strunk and White's Elements of Style. I think for most Americans, shall is more formal, sometimes used to express in a formal setting what you shall do, perhaps as obligation. And in legal settings, shall still can be used to express a formal legal obligation, lawyers often care about the difference between will and shall. The other modal in decline may surprise you, at least at first, and this is the modal must. Must has been in decline for much of the 20th century. Actually, it's not must in general, it's only deontic must, the one that expresses obligation or necessity. Once you reflect on it, I think you might agree that must now can feel awfully strong. If I were to say, I must run errands tonight after work. I must run errands. I think many of us would more typically say instead, I have to run errands tonight after work. I have to run errands. This example of I have to run errands points to the rise of a new set of auxiliary verbs that are emerging, sometimes called semi-modals or emerging modals. That's what we're calling them until we decide they've made it into the modal category. These include have to and gonna. If we didn't have such a standardized spelling system, they would be spelled H-A-F-T-A, have to, and G-O-N-N-A, gonna, as that is how we say them. And in fact, gonna and going to now mean different things. And stick with me here because I'm sure I'm right. Let's say I say, I'm gonna run errands. I'm gonna run errands. There it's functioning as a modal about what I need to do. Compare this with, I am going to run errands. I am going to run errands. I think for most of us that would mean I'm on my way out the door. Maybe I'm getting in the car. Maybe I'm on foot. I'm going to run errands. I'll see you later. I'm out of here. We still recognize that these modals like have to and gonna are informal, and we don't tend to write them in formal prose. But their rise in American English is dramatic. And I would keep an eye on the other modal, supposed to. I'm supposed to go, which again, if we didn't have such standardized spelling, we would spell S-P-O-S-T-A. The significant changes I've been talking about here in the modal system are happening without a lot of fanfare or stigmatization, which is interesting to me. They may be considered more informal, have to and gonna, but I think most people don't consider them wrong. Before we finish this lecture on auxiliary verbs, we need to talk about ain't. This must be the most notorious auxiliary verb out there. Dictionaries tend to treat it as non-standard. Some people claim it isn't a word. As you may recall, Webster's Third New International Dictionary, published in the early 1960s, got into trouble, or at least was controversial, for the way it handled ain't, saying that many speakers use it and not labeling it as non-standard. Now, what is wrong with ain't? I have to say that mostly what's wrong with it is that style guides tell us there's something wrong with it. In the 18th century, there was a whole set of contractions that were condemned, including shouldn't, can't, won't, and ain't. All of these other contractions have redeemed themselves. They may be seen as informal, but they're not seen as ignorant, except for ain't. Now, one key point here is that almost all speakers of English use ain't at least some of the time. Some speakers use it routinely as part of their grammar. They use it for am not, is not, are not, has not, have not, and in some cases, do not and does not. Some speakers use it for emphasis, or perhaps in stock expressions like ain't gonna happen. Sometimes people will use it to create an unpretentious tone. But the stigma on ain't is still pretty strong when it's used as a part of one's daily speech. Let me give you an example of how this stigma around ain't can play out. This is an example from the news. It was in an article in USA Today by Christine Brennan in 2011, and it was about the former University of Michigan football coach, Rich Rodriguez, sometimes known as Rich Rod. Rich Rod was leaving the University of Michigan. He'd come to Michigan from West Virginia. The article starts by talking about how Rich Rod never really fit in at Michigan. And then it goes on to talk about how he gave this speech and a university regent got upset after the speech about his language. A staffer came to tell Rich Rod that somebody was upset about his language, and here I quote from the article. As Rodriguez frantically racked his brain to recall what he might have said, the staffer sheepishly offered up the offending word. Rodriguez had said eight. Some people say the problem with ain't is that it's not transparent. Ain't comes from amn't, am not. And over time, as it becomes ain't, it's less transparent. But won't, which comes from will not, is equally not transparent, and it is not condemned as being wrong or ignorant. Some people say, I don't like the sound of ain't. And my response is, how do you feel about the words paint and faint? And often they say, oh, well, those are fine. And I say, then why isn't ain't fine? And if you think about it, ain't I seems more systematic than aren't I. Why do we accept aren't I as standard when we do not accept I aren't? I point this out as one of the many examples of the ways in which what is considered standard is not necessarily more logical than the other possibilities. Defending the logic of ain't this way is not an assertion that ain't is standard usage. It clearly isn't. My linguistic defense of ain't is meant instead to ask us to think critically about the arguments we make about what is standard and non-standard usage, especially if we find ourselves making claims that one thing is more logical than another. This lecture on auxiliaries has set us up to spend the next lecture looking specifically at passive sentences, which use auxiliary be and a past participle. And passives raise a host of questions about what is okay and what is not okay in formal writing.
Lecture 13. Passive voice was corrected.
In 2009, the Chronicle of Higher Education published an essay called 50 Years of Stupid Grammar Advice. The article was written by Jeff Pullum, who's a linguist at the University of Edinburgh. He's also an active blogger for the terrific blog Language Log, and if you haven't already checked it out, I encourage you to do so, as well as for the equally terrific blog Lingua Franca for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and I should disclose here that I also blog for Lingua Franca. Jeff is not known for pulling his punches, especially when it comes to Strunken White's elements of style. The essay that Jeff wrote was published a day after the 50th anniversary of that book. It was first published on April 16th, 1959. And as the title of his essay makes clear, his article was far from celebratory. Jeff concedes that some of the style advice in Strunken White is fine, if not especially revolutionary. Advice like, be clear, yes, always a good idea, and omit needless words. Of course, the question is always figuring out which ones are needless. Jeff's concern is what he considers to be bad grammar advice. And grammar and style are not always clearly distinguished in Strunken White. Central to Jeff's case is the treatment of the passive voice in Strunken White. This entire lecture will focus on the passive voice, and Strunken White seems like a good place to start. So let's dive in. The relevant section in Elements of Style is called Use Active Voice. And it's going to become important that it is about using the active voice, not about not using the passive voice. So it's called Use the Active Voice, and then Strunken White give us the following advice. And here I'll quote. The active voice is usually more direct and vigorous than the passive. This rule does not, of course, mean that the writer should entirely discard the passive voice, which is frequently convenient and sometimes necessary. The habitual use of the active voice, however, makes for forcible writing. So that's Strunk and White on the passive. And I have to say that the leeway in this advice is really important. The passive is sometimes convenient or necessary. And as we'll talk about, the passive is also highly conventionalized in scientific writing and some other kinds of academic prose. Where Strunk and White run into trouble is that their examples potentially could confuse people about what is passive and what is not. Strunk and White provide four example sentences, and only one of them is passive, as I'll show you. Now, Strunk and White introduce the sentences by saying that they show, and here I'll quote, how a transitive verb in the active voice can improve a sentence. So really, Strunk and White have two things going on here in this advice: transitive verbs and active voice. But given that the whole section is called Use Active Voice and is about active voice, I think the transitive verb part can get lost. Let me give you the four sentences that are in Strunk and White in this section on using the active voice. First, there were a great number of dead leaves lying on the ground. Second, at dawn, the crowing of a rooster could be heard. Third, the reason that he left college was that his health became impaired. Fourth, it was not long before she was very sorry that she had said what she had. As I'm sure many of you caught, only the second sentence there is passive. At dawn, the crowing of a rooster could be heard. And we can see one of the ways in that sentence that the passive can create what I'll call stylistic stumbles. We don't know who in that sentence is doing the hearing. The passive in this sentence has inserted some odd unknown agent who's hearing the rooster, as opposed to just saying, the rooster crowed at dawn. And then we just assume that whoever heard it, heard it. So let's pause and just make sure we're all on the same page about what the passive is. Let's start with an active sentence. Here you get subject, verb, object, where the subject is the agent, the person or thing doing the verb, and then the object is the thing or person who or which is acted upon. Passive, that object, and in English, it can actually be a direct object or an indirect object, gets fronted in the sentence. Then the verb is transformed to take an auxiliary be, and then the main verb is put into the past participle. The subject is moved to the end, and you put a by in front of it to create a prepositional phrase. That prepositional phrase, by plus subject, also becomes optional. An example. The active, Big Bird tickled Cookie Monster. If we turn it into the passive, Cookie Monster was tickled by Big Bird. And I have to just explain here why these sentences came to mind. When I was an undergraduate, I worked in a language lab where we were studying how early kids learned the passive voice. And these were the sentences we were using, and kids were looking at monitors with a Cookie Monster and a Big Bird, and Cookie Monster was tickling Big Bird, and we were trying to see when they started understanding passive voice. So, to keep going with my passive voice examples, you can take a passive construction and add aspect. For example, let's add the progressive to our sentence about Big Bird and Cookie Monster. Big Bird, here's the active, Big Bird is tickling Cookie Monster. And then to make it passive, Cookie Monster is being tickled by Big Bird. The point is that the recipient of the action becomes the subject, and the agent moves to the end and becomes optional. The optionality of the agent is very helpful when we don't want to take responsibility for an action. Think about the famous statement, mistakes were made by someone who remains unnamed. We could take a more quotidian example at home where you say, the red shirt was put in with the whites in that load of laundry. The red shirt was put in with the whites. No one is taking responsibility for that red shirt getting in there. The fact that we can leave out the agent in a passive is also helpful when we don't know who's responsible. Think about a sentence like, my car was sideswiped in the parking lot. I don't know who sideswiped it. If I wanted to make it active, I would have to say something like, someone sideswiped my car in the parking lot. Or more likely, I would probably say, some turkey sideswiped my car in the parking lot. But it is an unidentified someone or turkey. You can also think about a sentence like, he was murdered. We don't know who murdered him. If you wanted to make that active, you'd have to say something like, someone murdered him, with that indefinite pronoun as your subject. Going back then to Strunk and White, what is happening in these other Strunk and White sentences if it's not the passive? What we're seeing in all of these sentences is the insertion of to be as a main verb where you don't need it, where it probably weakens the clout of the verb and often adds extra words to the sentence. Let's review each sentence in turn. Number one, there were a great number of dead leaves lying on the ground. This is just a pretty straightforward to be sentence, and the be became necessary when we added the introductory there, the there we often call existential there. There were a great number of leaves lying on the ground. So now we have two verbs in the sentence. We have the were in there were, and then we have the verbs lying on the ground. These kinds of there constructions are quite frequent in speech. But in writing, they're worth watching, as there were, which focuses our attention on what's about to come, also arguably adds extra words, maybe call them needless words. You can see why Strunk and White don't like this sentence. Is there a way that we can make lie or some other descriptive verb the main verb of the sentence? For example, dead leaves covered the ground. You'll notice that in that rewrite, I also got rid of a great number because the verb covers, to me, captures that there are a great number of leaves. Let's now look at sentence number three from Strunk and White. The reason that he left college was that his health became impaired. This sentence raises much of the same issue as the first sentence. The phrasing, the reason that X is Y, introduces to be as the main verb. And it is worth looking at whether, in context, we can just use a because construction instead. Can we say, he left college because his health became impaired? Now, you'll notice that in those two sentences, there is a shift in emphasis, and that's why I said you'd want to make sure you were rewriting this in context. It is really about whether we're emphasizing that he left college or why he left college. Let's imagine that I'm talking to someone who thinks that he, whoever he is, just quit college, and I want to emphasize that there was a reason. And so I say, no, the reason that he left college is... You can see how in context that wording works. Now the fourth sentence in Strunk and White. It was not long before she was very sorry that she had said what she had. Okay, there's a lot going on in this sentence. More than we probably need, I think. It was not long. Well, that could become soon or quickly. But again, I'm going to say that that will depend on what the writer wants to emphasize. If we say, it was not long before she did X, that's not exactly the same rhetorically or semantically as she quickly did X. Then we have the phrasing, she was very sorry, which could become she regretted. Really, that's a word choice issue that depends what verb you choose. Then we have the last part, she had said what she had, which could probably become she said what she did or she regretted her words. We need a little more context to rewrite that sentence. You can now see why putting all four of these sentences under the advice, use active voice, becomes potentially confusing, particularly in terms of equating all uses of to be as a main verb with the passive voice. And that is Jeff Pullum's concern. I don't think the concern is unfounded, given what I have seen in classrooms at all levels, where sentences like number 1 and 3 and 4, where you have to be as a main verb, are getting identified as passives. As I've talked about, all of these sentences could probably benefit from some revision, but not because they are all in the passive voice. It is good advice that every time we use the verb to be as a main verb in our writing, that we go back and look at those and see if there is some more dynamic or evocative verb that we could use instead. This may simultaneously change the syntax of the sentence, sometimes in good ways. So that advice of be careful about those to be verbs is worth heeding. It's not that there's anything grammatically wrong with be as a main verb, but stylistically, you may be able to do better, at least some of the time. You may be able to avoid repetition. In part, it's because we use be a lot as a main verb in speech, and so it can get into our writing as a very frequent main verb, and getting it out of there so that you don't have too many sentences with to be as a main verb is good. It can also be good in terms of concision. As I showed you in rewriting some of those sentences, when you took out the to be verb, the sentence sometimes tightened up. So what is better advice about the passive? Here's what I would say. In every instance, consider whether a passive construction is the most rhetorically effective choice. I'm not just being wishy-washy here. There are several reasons why it might be the best choice rhetorically, why you might want to use the passive, and I'm going to outline those reasons here. Before I do, let's look at some of the passives you probably should rewrite because they are not rhetorically effective. Here's the kind of sentence that I have to say I do see in student writing fairly often. I think sometimes the passive gets in there because students are trying to be more formal and somehow the passive feels more formal. Here is two sentences. The second one is passive. The exam began. The shuffling of paper was heard in the room. Again, like the rooster sentence, we have this odd unnamed hearer who has suddenly been introduced into the picture who's hearing the shuffling. We could just change this sentence to something like, the shuffling of paper filled the room. Here's another example of a sentence in the passive that is not great. A more streamlined process was envisioned by the committee. That sentence is probably better if we let the committee be the subject. The committee envisioned a more streamlined process. But I am going to say that it depends on exactly where that sentence is in a paragraph and what it's trying to do. Let me explain. There are times where to maintain continuity from sentence to sentence, the passive helps us. To show you what I mean here, I'm going to talk about the opening two sentences from a blog post that I wrote a few months ago. The first sentence of the blog post was, I have a new favorite mug, which was true. Then my second sentence was, it was given to me by graduate students in the English and Education program. You'll notice that that second sentence is passive. I could have said, I have a new favorite mug. Graduate students in the English and Education program gave it to me. But you'll notice that when I take that second sentence and put it into the active, there's suddenly a jump. I was talking about the mug, and now I'm talking about the graduate students who gave it to me. In the passive, I'm talking about the mug. I have a new favorite mug. It was given to me, and we get that continuity across sentences. So that's one reason the passive voice may be rhetorically effective. Sometimes, as we've talked about, we don't know the agent, and the passive is very helpful here. Think about some of the terrible news we hear, where reporters need to be careful not to assume agents before we know who the agents are. An example like, two people were shot last night, or The store was set on fire sometime early this morning. You need passive constructions there. Then there is scientific writing. Scientific writing tends to follow a set of unique, or at least unusual, but I'm going to call them unique conventions, in terms of how articles are structured overall. For example, you have a method section, a results section, and then a discussion section. And the passive has become more and more conventionalized in this register of scientific writing, than in many others. Let's think about the description of an experiment. When you think about an experiment, in fact, researchers are doing most of the actions. They're taking the sample, they're putting it in a petri dish, they're adding whatever they're adding, and so on. If we told the experiment like a story, there'd be a lot of people involved. We'd be saying things like, we took the sample, and we put it in a petri dish, and then we added this to it. But certainly at this point, that no longer sounds very scientific to us. That sounds more like a story. Instead, let's try making it sound more scientific. The sample was placed in the petri dish, and then X was added to the sample. Clearly, there were human agents putting things in that petri dish and adding things to it, but they disappeared from the grammar. The human agents are invisible or at least very marginalized. The specimens themselves take center stage in that description, which is important. I mean, in science, often we do want people to focus on what the experiment was about, not the people who were doing it. And so the passive can help there. The passive can also make this scientific experiment sound more objective, more scientific. That can be a really good thing, but it is important for us to remember that it can also hide, or at least obscure from view, make marginal, those human decisions in an experiment, and perhaps the bias that can happen with an experiment, and the uncertainty that is part of humans doing experiments. Here is a great example of the passive voice in scientific writing from the Journal of Experimental Biology. It's from an article called Biomechanical Control of Vocal Plasticity in the Echolocating Bat. Yes, we're going to talk about bats. Here is an excerpt from the article. Six individuals of adult Philostomus discolor, three males and three females, were tested in an echo and sound attenuated acoustic chamber. Okay, so they were tested clearly by people, but the people are not part of the grammar. Let me continue with the passage. During the experiment, two bats were tested simultaneously, with bats held individually in pyramidal mesh cages. So now the bats are being held, again, by humans, but they're just being held. Onwards. Bats were assigned to the same pairs throughout the experiment. Sound recording and noise playback were synchronized through an audio interface. Bat vocalizations were continuously sampled at 192 kilohertz. Right, so we can see they're being sampled, somebody's sampling them, but we're not told who. And the excerpt ends with, and it's talking about specific data, these data were saved to hard disk. Obviously, there's a person doing that saving, but we just know that the data were saved. This passage now strikes us as just typical scientific writing. Those vocalizations were continuously sampled. The data were saved. The bats were tested. But, as I noted, scientific writing doesn't have to happen that way. There are rhetorical reasons it's happening. It allows us to focus on the bats and what's happening to the bats. It also doesn't allow us necessarily, or doesn't help us imagine the humans who are holding the bats. Scientific writing has not always worked that way. To show you what I mean, I'm going to give you a passage from the 18th century. This is a passage from the physiologist John Hunter from a work in 1775. I'm pulling this excerpt from work by Dwight Atkinson, who's been looking at the history of scientific writing. you'll see that Hunter is using some passive, very object-centered language at the beginning of this passage. But then the language shifts. Here's the passage. The first experiment was made on two carp. Right? So you see the passive. The experiment was made on two carp. Here, and now I will continue with Hunter. They were put into a glass vessel with common river water, and the vessel put into freezing mixture. The water did not freeze fast enough, and therefore, to make it freeze sooner, we put in as much cooled snow as to make the hole thick. The snow round the carp melted, we put in more snow, which melted also, and this was repeated several times, till we grew tired. I love this passage because it's so wonderfully human. You can imagine the people taking the snow and packing it around the carp until they get tired. We probably would not let a student now write up a lab report this way, but it is important to remember that the conventions of scientific writing are something that we've all come to agree on over time. You see Hunter, who has this mixture of the more passive, object-centered language, along with this much more narrative language, where we can see him and his fellow experimenters experimenting with the carp. There are a few other passive phrases that are now commonplaces in academic writing, beyond scientific writing, that don't typically get edited out as ineffective passives. These would be passives like, it could be argued, or other relevant factors must be considered. It could be argued is a way we introduce counterarguments into our writing as part of defending our own claims. These arguments may have been argued by others, or they may be hypothetical, but it doesn't actually matter who argued them. We need to get them into our writing as part of constructing our own argument and addressing possible counterarguments. With X must be considered, it can be a solution to what I call the abstract we problem in academic writing. If you were going to make this active, you'd probably need to say something like, we must consider other relevant factors. And my question is, who is we? The authors? The author and the readers? All researchers in the field? All researchers in the field and the readers? So here I would say, pick your poison. With, you can use the passive and say, these things must be considered, or you can choose the abstract we must consider them. Both of those options present some stylistic issues. While we're talking about the passive, let's talk about a variant that doesn't use be, but instead uses get. For example, my car got sideswiped in the parking lot, or she got arrested. These get passives feel, I think for most of us, much more colloquial, not something we're going to write in formal settings, that we wouldn't tend to say the test tube got warmed to 100 degrees. We would say it was warmed. In addition to being more colloquial, get passives may also mean slightly differently from be passives. They may carry a difference in connotation. It could be about the responsibility of the grammatical subject. For example, Mario got fired. I think for many of us, that means something slightly different from Mario was fired, at least in terms of connotations. Mario got fired. I think Mario has to take a little more responsibility for getting fired. It's like Mario got himself fired. The get passive may also reflect the attitude of the speaker toward the event, perhaps expressing adversity or benefit. For example, my car got hit. And I think that that is my own sense of adversity, that my car got hit. Or let's say I'm trying to express sympathy for someone. She got cheated. That expresses my sympathy for her. Get passives, which can still feel quite colloquial, are older than you might guess. They're first attested in the mid to late 17th century, although they're only sporadic in that period. And it's really not until the late 18th century that they take off. So the get passive is in place in the grammar before another change starts to take place. And we'll end the lecture with this change. The 19th century witnessed the rise of the passive progressive in English. What is that? It is the passive that is in progress. So it is a sentence like, the house is being built. Now, this sentence is completely mundane now, but people hated it when it came into the language in the 19th century. Here is George P. Marsh in Lectures on the English Language, published in 1863, and he's talking about this new passive progressive, which he describes this way. The clumsy and unidiomatic continuing present of the passive voice, which originating not in the sound common sense of the people, but in the brain of some grammatical pretender, has widely spread and threatens to establish itself as another solecism in addition to the many which our syntax already presents. The phrase, the house is being built, for the house is building, is an awkward neologism, an attempt at the artificial improvement of the language in a point which needed no amendment. I think this criticism can seem so funny to us now because a sentence like the house is being built doesn't even seem worthy of notice, let alone criticism. But criticism it got. Here is David Booth in an analytical dictionary of the English language, which was published in 1830, so a few decades earlier. And he writes, for some time past, the bridge is being built, the tunnel is being excavated, and other expressions of a like kind have pained the eye and stunned the ear. What's interesting here is that in an earlier edition of that book, published in 1805, he doesn't mention the passive progressive. Clearly, it wasn't in such wide circulation that it was on his radar. Richard Grant White also addressed the passive progressive in 1869. He described it as the worst of, and here I quote him, those intruders in language which about 70 or 80 years ago began to affront the eye, torment the ear, and assault the common sense of the speaker of plain and idiomatic English. But Richard Grant White had to admit in the end that the passive progressive, and here again I'll quote, seems to many persons to be of established respectability. Now, it is, of course, completely respectable now to use the passive progressive. In fact, we think it sounds a little odd not to use it and to say the house is building instead of the house is being built. Did people really say the house is building as a passive? Yes, they did. Let me give you an example from Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, which you may or may not have noticed if you've read the novel. Here's the sentence. The clock struck 10 while the trunks were carrying down. This is not how we'd now say that. We would say while the trunks were being carried down. Here's a second example. This one's from Samuel Richardson's novel, Sir Charles Grandison, published in 1753. And this example is cited in a very nice discussion of the passive progressive on the blog Grammarphobia. Here are the two sentences from the work. Tea was preparing. Sir Charles took his own seat next Lord L, whom he set into talk of Scotland. Tea was preparing. This way of doing the passive progressive, the bags were carrying down, tea was preparing, now sounds funny to us. While the tea is being prepared sounded funny to people in the 19th century. All of this is a good reminder of how grammar changes over time, as well as how what is considered standard and abominable, an assault to the eye and an affront to the ear, can also change over time. Speaking of which, does it affront your ear when you hear Apple's slogan, "Think Different"? If so, you're not alone, and the next lecture is for you.
Lecture 14, Only Adverbs.
two well-known company slogans have raised some grammatical hackles based on their use or non-use of adverbs. This seemed like a good place to start our lecture on adverbs. So what are these slogans? Subway Restaurant has long used the slogan, "Eat Fresh." And in 1997, Apple rolled out "Think Different." Do we have grammatical problems here? Eat fresh. Let's start with eat fresh. Eat fresh sounds a lot like eat right. But right can clearly be an adverb as well as an adjective. We talk about the right choice, adjective, this fits right, adverb. Eat fresh also sounds like eat well, but well clearly established as an adverb. This leaves us with the question of whether fresh can also be an adverb. Fresh is usually an adjective. We talk about fresh flowers, the fish are fresh, but fresh can be an adverb. For example, the bread is baked fresh every day. We could also there say the bread is baked freshly every day, but fresh there is pretty clearly an adverb. So what about eat fresh? Well, eat fresh works differently from baked fresh. Baked fresh means baked recently, but that's clearly not what fresh means in eat fresh. Perhaps eat fresh is just a shortening of eat fresh food. Or perhaps it's a non-standard meaning of the adverb fresh, where eat fresh means that you eat fresh things. We know what it means, even if we're not quite sure how the grammar's working. And the point is that that means the slogan has done its work. We noticed the language, and here we are talking about it. Let's talk about Think Different, the Apple slogan. Standard grammar, arguably, would be think differently. But this also means differently. Think differently means think in different ways versus think about different things. We do have expressions like think big, and there big is functioning as an adverb. Think in big ways, maybe also about big things. We also get the expression talk big, where the adverb big means boastfully. Now, different can be an adverb. The American Heritage Dictionary has the example, Carol didn't know different until Eleanor told her, where different is clearly an adverb. So in think different, is different an adjective or an adverb? Is it asking us to think about different kinds of computers or to think differently about computers? Now, I have to say, this ad didn't win an Emmy for nothing. The ambiguity is brilliant. There's an interesting article from a 2011 issue of Forbes by Rob Siltanen, who was a creative director and managing partner at the ad agency that came up with Think Different, and he was part of the team that was involved in the process. He tells us that Think Different was based on Think IBM. And then it was paired with different thinking people like Einstein and Gandhi. The ambiguity of think different is possible because English has words that can be both adjectives and adverbs without changing form. Words like big and fast. And we'll come back to those as flat adverbs when we talk about flat adverbs. For now, I think we just recognize that think different is a brilliant play on the ambiguity between adjectives and adverbs in English when words don't change form. This seems like a good moment to try to define an adverb, except that there is never a good moment to define an adverb. As I mentioned before, adverbs are sometimes described as the trash can category of English grammar, that we're putting in apples, oranges, and grapefruits and calling them all adverbs. Here's Merriam-Webster defining an adverb. A word that describes a verb, an adjective, another adverb, or a sentence, and that is often used to show time, manner, place, or degree. In other words, Unlike adjectives, which consistently modify nouns, adverbs modify a whole range of things. They can modify verbs, for example, go quickly, protest peacefully. They can modify adjectives, incredibly nice, very happy. There you're seeing those intensifiers like very. Intensifiers are considered adverbs. Adverbs can modify other adverbs, really stupidly, ridiculously slowly. And then adverbs can modify entire clauses or sentences. For example, frankly, this situation with adverbs is a mess. As you can see, it's hard to pin down adverbs in terms of what they modify. They're equally hard to pin down in terms of where they appear in the clause or sentence. When they're modifying a verb, for example, they can move around. Let me give you an example. She wrote the email quickly. They are the adverbs at the end. She quickly wrote the email. Now the adverb has moved between the subject and the verb. Quickly, she wrote the email. Now it's right at the beginning of the sentence. The one that we probably can't do is she wrote quickly the email. Let's look at what happens when the adverb is modifying the entire clause. Once again, we're going to see a lot of flexibility about where this can go. Frankly, this situation is a mess. There are that adverbs at the front. This situation, frankly, is a mess. Now we've put it after the subject before the verb. This situation is, frankly, a mess. Now it's come between the verb and the predicate noun. And finally, this situation is a mess, frankly. Now we've put it all the way at the end of the sentence. The only thing we can't do here is break up this situation and put frankly right into the middle of that, because that's a noun phrase, and we can't put it right in the middle of a mess. Most of this time, this flexibility with adverbs in terms of where they can go in a sentence is not an issue. But then there's the adverb only and where it's supposed to go. Let me give you an example. You ask to borrow some money for coffee, and I give you $2. You are disgruntled and say, Ann only gave me $2. Have you made an error? Some would say that what you should have said is, Ann gave me only $2. Versus, and here we'll see, Ann only gave me $2. She loaned me $10. You can see it's about what the only is modifying. Do you care, or does this seem overly nitpicky to you? Brian Garner, in Modern American Usage, calls this issue with only, he calls only perhaps the most frequently misplaced word in English. When you hear that, you should ask, if it happens so frequently, is it really misplaced? But Garner here is echoing a long-standing concern about only. And before I continue with only, I just want to pause here to remind you of why I'm talking so often about particular style guides, like Brian Garner's Modern American Usage, Strunk and White's Elements of Style, H.W. Fowler's book on usage. I've decided to focus on these because they are very influential, well-established usage guides. They're the kinds of guides that we often go to look for advice. I could choose from a whole range of grammars, and I expect that many of you are using a range of them. I've picked some of the better known ones so that we can look at what they say and evaluate the kinds of advice that we're finding in these usage guides, that we can think about that advice from the perspective I'm offering in this course of what are we being prescribed, what are we being told to do compared with actual usage, and decide what we want to do as writers. Now back to only. As I said, Garner is echoing a concern about only, and this concern goes way back, as early as Bishop Louth in 1763. And Louth went after the sentence, I only spoke three words, or the equivalent of that sentence, I only spoke three words, instead of, I spoke only three words. Now, what's the objection here? The objection is that it is arguably ambiguous if we apply strict logic to the sentence. If the focus is that it was just three words that I spoke, then only should come before three words. I spoke only three words. If the focus is what you spoke versus, for example, what you wrote, then only should come before spoke. I only spoke three words. If the focus is on you speaking versus others, then only can still come before spoke. For example, I only spoke three words. In speech, intonation would address much of this issue, but in writing, the argument is that we need to be much more careful about the placement of that only, and that's a fair argument to make. Some later grammarians called Louth hypercritical on only. They noted that English likes to put only before the verb. Fowler himself defends this misplaced only in the sentence, "The man only died a week ago." If we were trying to apply that logic, we would say, "The man died only a week ago." But if we say, "The man only died a week ago," we know that those mean the same thing. Let's think about only as we encounter it in published prose and see if you would notice the placement of only in the following two sentences. Here's the first one. "We feel very badly about your only having one turkey." You're only having one turkey instead of you're having only one turkey. This comes from James Thurber. Here's the second one. "Every other author may aspire to praise. The lexicographer can only hope to escape reproach." That's Samuel Johnson. And if we were following the logic here, you would say not only hope to escape, but hope only to escape. Now, clearly these sentences aren't confusing. So are we quibbling over too fine a point of usage? This issue is addressed in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage, which I highly recommend as a resource. It's a great place to find historical information about points of usage that you're interested in. So Merriam-Webster, which provides the two sentences I just gave you, points out that, in fact, when you look at edited prose, the sentences I gave you are actually a little bit exceptional. The only does tend to appear before the phrase it modifies. It does appear to be something that writers and perhaps their editors are paying attention to. Here's Thurber again with the only in the quote-unquote correct place. "Indeed, we spent so little time in bed that most of us had only one child." Is it worth editing for this? Should you be watching your onlys? I would say maybe. At least some of the time. It's probably a good practice. Here's an example where it does matter where the only goes. And this example comes from the editors of the American Heritage Dictionary. "Dictators respect only force. They are not moved by words." So there we see, "Dictators respect only force." Only puts the focus on force. And then we can contrast that with, "They are not moved by words." Now see what happens when we move the only. "Dictators only respect force. They do not worship it." "Dictators only respect force" puts the focus on respect. "They do not worship it." That's a place where the placement of the only matters. But let's be clear that here, this is about disambiguating sentences that require it. Often, where only is in the sentence does not create that kind of confusion. In sum, the issue with only really stems from the flexibility that many adverbs show in terms of sentence placement, but not all of them are that flexible. That takes us to intensifiers, which are a subset of adverbs, and they are much less flexible about where they can appear. They appear right before adjectives and adverbs. These are words like very, really, truly, so. When we say things like very happy, really fast, truly superb, so egregiously. Very and really are perhaps the most generic intensifiers right now and the most common ones, but the most common ones change over time. Sally Tagliamonte and Chris Roberts at the University of Toronto have done a study of intensifiers, and they show a layered history of these, where you have intensifiers coming in and replacing other intensifiers. They start with well as an intensifier, which is then replaced by full as an intensifier, which is then replaced by right as an intensifier. In a